Welcome back, fellow history sleuths, to another episode of Historical True Crime, the podcast that takes a look back at history's darkest crimes and criminals. I'm your host, Lizzie, and today is episode 74. We're diving deep into the life and crimes of Edward Ruloff. His story is one of intellect, deception, and ultimately tragedy. Ruloff was born in 1819 in Canada, and although his early years appeared ordinary, there was a mind of unmatched intelligence hidden beneath the surface. Having been born with a remarkable brain, he became well known for his voracious curiosity. But as we'll soon find out, intelligence is frequently a double-edged sword. Ruloff's path took an unsettling turn when his brilliance mixed with a penchant for dishonesty and crime. His goal was to outsmart the laws that govern society, not only to become an academic expert. Perhaps more fascinating than Ruloff's intelligence or his illegal activities is the complex web of paradoxes that shaped his personality. Was he a lunatic, a genius, or something else completely? Join me as we peel back the layers of myth and legend to uncover the truth behind Edward Ruloff, from his audacious crimes to his captivating courtroom drama. This is a story that will leave you on the edge of your seat. The case of Edward Ruloff is waiting, so grab your magnifying glass and sharpen your mind. You never know what secrets you might discover once you step inside his mind, so proceed with caution. The Man of Two Lives was the title of an Edward Ruloff biography published in 1871. Ruloff worked as a physician, attorney, schoolteacher, carpet designer, inventor, phrenologist, and photographer. He was also known by the names James Nelson, E.C. Howard, James Dalton, Edward Leoro, and others. Notably, Ruloff was a philologist who was fluent in six languages, as well as Latin and Greek. He was also working on a manuscript called Method in the Formation of Language, which he thought would completely change the discipline. Ruloff's life was paradoxical, in that he used thievery to fund his studies and spent a large portion of his time in prison studying philology. Not much is known of Ruloff's early years, but with his father's death in 1827, his mother was left to raise their three children. Ruloff's hopes of attending college were dashed by the family's financial difficulties. And at the age of 16, he left school to work as a clerk in a dry goods store. It seems like this is where his criminal career started. There were several fires that were thought to be arson attempts in order to hide inventory thefts. Ruloff was found guilty of embezzlement and sentenced to 2 years in prison after he was discovered wearing a suit that had been among the stolen goods. He would immigrate to the United States following his release, where he eventually found employment on the Erie Canal. It was there he made an impression on Will Schuett, a resident of Tompkins County, and he was invited into his home. Schuett's younger sister Harriet would later become Ruloff's wife and his most well-known victim. When Edward Ruloff first arrived at the Schuett farm in Dryden in the middle of 1842, he appeared to be a very remarkable man. He could speak German, Greek, and Latin, and he was soon employed as a schoolteacher. Among his students was a teenage girl named Harriet, who developed a deep romantic interest in the learned older man. Their courtship continued after Ruloff started training as an herbal medicine doctor in Ithaca. Though there are differing opinions on when Ruloff's real colors began to show, whether his volatile temper and violent tendencies had been evident before the marriage, the couple did tie the knot on the last day of 1843. Priscilla, named after Ruloff's mother, was the couple's first child, a daughter born in April 1845. But his wife and child would disappear merely 2 months later. But first, William Schuett's young daughter and his wife Amelia fell unwell in May. Will would beg Edward for help because he knew Ruloff knew about medicine and herbal remedies. Ruloff took care of them both, but they remained unwell, and in June the infant passed away, her mother following shortly thereafter. Edward's own wife and daughter would vanish in the same month, only around 2 weeks after the solemn double funeral. When Harriet borrowed soap from a neighbor on June 23rd, it would be the last time anyone saw her. At that point, she had made no mention of leaving. Later that day, a small girl who was visiting with Harriet and Priscilla also reported there had been no indication of an approaching trip. According to Ramsland for Crime Library, there was activity in the Ruloff home during the evening. It seems that Edward and Harriet had gotten into a fight about their future plans. Edward wanted to move to the West in search of better employment opportunities, while Harriet wanted to stay near her family. Years later, Edward would tell Ham Freeman a version of these events, saying that after an argument about the child, he seized a pestle he used to break medications and hit Harriet in the head. He said he did his best to revive her and tend to the wound, but she remained unconscious and died sometime during the night. Apart from giving his daughter a drug to stop her from screaming, Edward never told anyone what took place. Harriet and Priscilla both just simply disappeared, and he would tell different tales about Harriet walking out on her own. But Edward got his biggest chest and knocked on his neighbor's door to ask for a horse and cart. Throughout the night, he steadily made his way towards Cayuga Lake's southern edge. He rowed a stolen boat into the dark waters, opened a trunk, and dumped out the contents after estimating where the lake's deepest point would be. By the time an investigation was opened, Edward had already left the area. When police examined his home, they discovered Harriet's belongings and no proof that she had ever left. Edward claimed to have relocated the family to Ohio when he got back to Lansing, but he was not believed. And after he would escape once again, he was eventually hunted down, apprehended, and accused of murder. But the absence of their bodies presented an issue for the murder charge. Police believed that Ruloff had sunk the bodies in Lake Cayuga, but repeated dredging had produced no results. Nevertheless, Edward was put on trial in 1846. He led his own defense and attempted to emphasize the absence of evidence. But the jury was inclined to find him guilty of something. So he was convicted not of murder, but of kidnapping, and received a 10-year sentence to serve in Auburn Prison. Edward would start to develop his own hypothesis on language evolution while he was detained, and planned to publish it as The Great Secret in Philology after his release. He was even permitted to instruct students from inside his own cell. But his dreams of beginning a profession in that area were shattered. Because on the day Edward was released in 1856, another warrant was issued for his arrest, this time on the suspicion of his wife's murder. He traveled to Ithaca with the sheriff. After hearing Edward's claims that this amounted to double jeopardy, District Attorney John Williams decided to withdraw the charge. But because of the overwhelming public outcry, Williams would prepare a second indictment, this time for Priscilla's murder. Now, Edward maintained his innocence and requested a change of venue, which was approved. The trial was scheduled to begin in Owego, New York's Tioga County. Edward was put on trial once again and found guilty. But he appealed. This time, however, the ruling was upheld. While being held in the Ithaca jail pending sentencing, Edward began to teach Latin and Greek to the undersheriff's son, Albert Jarvis. He'd also grow close to Jane, his mother, who didn't think that Edward was a killer. And in 1857, likely with their help, Edward broke out of prison. There were 8 locks between the cell and the outside, in addition to a chain around his ankle, making it very evident that he had to have some kind of inside help. Almost immediately, a $500 reward for Edward's capture was announced. A handbill detailing everything he'd worn was circulated throughout the county. People would learn that the murderer weighed around 180 pounds, stood 5 feet 10 inches tall, and had a huge head and thick neck. The police even said he could be wearing a disguise. But Edward didn't stay on the run for long. He was recaptured, and a second trial was ordered after Edward managed to successfully appeal once again. Ithaca residents, fed up with waiting for justice, organized a lynch mob and prepared to storm the jail. But before any harm could be done, Edward was sent off to Auburn. Then he would be extradited to Erie, Pennsylvania, where he was wanted for diamond theft. But again, Ruloff wasn't prosecuted. In fact, he was free now, despite the fact that almost everyone in Western New York believed he was guilty of kidnapping, theft, assault, fraud, jailbreaking, and murder. In addition to being free, the Ruloff rule, which stated that the principle that the mere absence of a person was not enough to prove their death, but that additional evidence was needed to convict someone of their murder became enshrined in New York law for decades. After that, Edward turned his attention to two things: producing his masterpiece in philology, the study of language evolution and structure, and committing crimes to support his way of life. One of his many numerous crimes would land him in Sing Sing Prison in 1861, where he spent more than 2 years and would make the acquaintance of Billy Dexter, who, together with Jarvis, would complete Edward's little group of fraudsters and thieves. The group based in New York had a special penchant for stealing expensive textiles that were difficult to track down. The burglary of the Halbert Brothers' dry goods business in Binghamton would be the gang's last theft and would ultimately lead to their downfall and demonstrate that despite his intelligence and criminal nature, Edward Ruloff was not a criminal genius. Two clerks who slept in the store as a kind of overnight watch encountered Ruloff, Jarvis, and Dexter as they stormed into Halbert's in August 1870. One of the watchmen, Fred Merrick, would be murdered in the struggle. The gang would jump into the river to try and escape, but both Jarvis and Dexter would drown. Edward was apprehended on his way out of town. He almost managed to talk his way out of it, but he had left shoes behind at the crime scene, and one matched his left foot, which happened to be missing a left toe that he lost due to frostbite. When it was revealed that Edward had previously escaped justice for a double homicide, the case gained national attention. In a courtroom intended to hold half that number of people, nearly 2,000 would watch Edward's murder trial every day, thanks to widespread media coverage. In addition to an eyewitness, Gilbert Burrows, the prosecution would also call witnesses from Brooklyn. Once more taking the lead in his own defense, Edward maintained that he was not at the store on the night of the murder, and that the murderer's actions would have been self-defense anyways rather than premeditation. The jury deliberated for 4.5 hours, debating the seriousness of the crime rather than his guilt. While some pressed for second degree or manslaughter, the majority demanded first degree murder. And ultimately on March 3, 1871, Edward was found guilty of first degree murder and given the death penalty. Edward promised to complete his book before being put to death that evening as he ignited his oil lamp in his prison cell and turned open his manuscript. His hanging date would be postponed by 2.5 months due to appeals. The case would gain even more national attention while he was pending execution. Some believed it was unethical to kill such a smart man, who might be close to making a significant intellectual discovery. According to Murder by Gaslight, Horace Greeley, owner of the New York Tribune, wrote, "In the prison in Binghamton, there is a man awaiting death, who is too curious an intellectual problem to be wasted on the gallows." Still others, including a few scholarly philologists, thought that Edward was just a clever fraud. Greeley's stance was even parodied by Mark Twain in a letter to the New York Tribune, where he said, "If a life be offered up to the gallows to atone for the murder Ruloff did, will that suffice? If so, I will bring forward a man who, in the interest of learning and science, will take Ruloff's crime upon himself and submit to be hanged in Ruloff's place." Now, people in New York ascribed multiple murders to Edward, although Edward stated that Al Jarvis and Billy Dexter died because they believed the river was sufficiently shallow for them to walk across and that neither man could swim. The public believed that Edward had killed them in order to avoid being identified. In addition, many believed that he had murdered his sister-in-law and her child, who passed away while receiving medical attention from him just before Harriet vanished. And as always, he's still accused of killing his wife and daughter. In order for Edward to complete his manuscript, his attorney proposed a plea to postpone his execution. In an attempt to gauge Edward's level of knowledge, his attorney would bring in almost a dozen academics from throughout the nation to the jail. Following a brief discussion with Edward, none of them would agree to sign the petition. One said that although Edward was smart, his system for merely accessing human language needed improvement and cooperation from other scholars. 3 days before his scheduled execution on May 18, 1871, Edward would contemplate his tumultuous life. His book was finished, but the academics he wanted to impress ridiculed it. He worried his life was now permanently marked by worthlessness. And on May 18, 1871, Edward was taken to the gallows. His execution was a ghastly scene. When he was hung, his neck didn't break, it only dislocated. So he was brutally strangled for more than 20 minutes. His would be the final public execution in New York State. Critics of the death sentence would use Edward's execution as a means to fight against the death penalty, while some believed it was a fitting end to a life dominated by brutality. Edward had anticipated that a lot of people would be interested in his body after death, and he was right. One man created a death mask to showcase at his gallery. After that, his body was put on display for everyone to see. Ruloff's brother would never appear to claim his body, so it would be sent to Dr. George Burr of the Geneva Medical College. He said that he would bury the bones, but he was interested in Edward's skull and brains. He hoped that by measuring Edward's gray matter and/or cranial structure, science might reveal something about his criminal nature. Dr. Burr would measure the length and depth of each fold and fissure in Edward's brain with meticulous attention to detail. He stated, height of the middle lobes, 4 1/3 inches. He looked for anomalies such as evident damage or blood stains. The doctor's final report contained a wealth of information, but it was also laced with strange claims about a deformed mind based on 19th century brain imaging studies. Scientists of the Victorian era believed that the brain was naturally divided into distinct regions, each of which controlled an individual's behavior. Edward provided neat justifications for why he was a murderer without a conscience, citing his completely large animal portion and smaller moral portion. His brain's circuitry had doomed him from the start. We now understand that there is no animal or moral section. The cerebrum, which is divided into 4 lobes, regulates speech, cognition, motor functions, and digestion, but not morality, is one of the 3 main parts of the brain, along with the brainstem and cerebellum. Though respected alienists disagreed, neurologists in 1871 might have determined that Edward's bad brain was to blame. He was interrogated in prison by the psychiatrists, who were entrusted with finding some evidence of his lunacy. The American Journal of Insanity and the Journal of Psychological Medicine both published the alienist's findings. They all agreed that Edward was bright but troubled, yet he was also in sound physical health and entirely sane. Morally, his execution was right. It would take more than a century for mental health issues like narcissism and antisocial personality disorders to be acknowledged. Today, Edward's diagnosis most likely would be very different. The most significant measurement made by Dr. Burr in his lab in 1871 was that he noted it was the largest and heaviest brain he had ever seen, writing, weight 59 ounces. Edward's extraordinary brain was covered extensively by reputable medical journals. Dr. Burr gave a presentation of his research to the distinguished Medico-Legal Society members, who gathered to discuss the problems surrounding the nexus between law and science. One of the world's leading brain anatomists, Bert Green Wilder of Cornell University, paid $15 for Edward's brain, based on its reputation in scientific research. Edward's brain was so valuable, in fact, that it was the first brain acquired in America's brain collection. However, as we currently understand, and as Dr. Wilder quickly discovered, having a large brain does not mean intelligence. The human brain is still a mystery, despite countless studies, which makes the brain defense a risky precedent. Furthermore, the question of whether the brain can predict criminal behavior is so contentious that not even the most reputable neuropsychologists in the nation can agree on it. But apart from Edward's brain, the exact number of his victims is still unknown more than a century later. But there is a widespread legend that maintains that Edward was not guilty of the most horrific act, the death of his infant daughter. Coincidentally, Edward had a younger brother who had a child, his niece also named Priscilla, who was born in the same year as his missing daughter. Is it possible that an accomplice took Edward's daughter to his brother's house in Maine at the time, and he claimed her as his own? The answer to that we'll likely never know. Now, one particularly eerie thing that Edward supposedly said while awaiting execution, in which he vowed to haunt Ithaca for all eternity, helped to solidify Edward's mythology that lives on to this day. Allegedly, he said, "You cannot kill an unquiet spirit, and I know that my impending death will not mean the end of Rulof. In the dead of the night walking along Cayuga Street, you will sense my presence. When you wake to a sudden chill, I will be in the room. And when you find yourself alone at the lake shore, gazing away at Grey Cayuga, know that I was cut short, and your ancestors killed me." Now, Rulof likely didn't actually say any of those words out loud, but it's also even more unlikely that he said his most famous quote. "Hurry it up," Rulof allegedly told the hangman. "I want to be in hell in time for dinner." And with that, the life and crimes of Edward Rulof will come to a close, but the enigma surrounding him will persist. With his death, Edward left behind a legacy shrouded in mystery and speculation. Was he truly a brilliant mind trapped in a criminal's body, or simply a cunning manipulator driven by greed and ego? The debate rages on, fueled by the tantalizing fragments of truth scattered throughout history. And as for Edward's ominous vow to haunt the streets of Ithaca forever, it remains to be seen whether his restless spirit ever finds peace. But one thing is for certain, the tale of Edward Rulof, the man of two lives, will continue to captivate and intrigue generations to come, a cautionary tale of the complexities of the human psyche and the enduring allure of the unknown. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you did, please remember to review, rate, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Instagram at Historical True Crime Pod or on Facebook at Historical True Crime Podcast. If you have any suggestions for something for us to cover in an upcoming episode, you can also email us directly at historicaltruecrimepod@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week for another dark and notorious case from history. We'll see you then.